Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 108, where we will discuss Irving Goffman's book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, originally published in 1956 and revised by Anchor Books in 1959. This is part one of the episode where we present Goffman's proposed framework, explaining wide ranges of human behaviors across social and organizational settings. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sam calling from Mexico City.
This is Greta calling from the beautiful town of Dordrecht.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome to an episode where we're going to kind of step a little bit outside of the mainstream of organization studies, but talk about something that has such profound impact on organizations. We just couldn't pass this one up. This is Irving Goffman's The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And this was published, it was 1959. And the whole book is oriented on the types of, and he uses a lot of theatrical metaphors here. And so we're going to be using a lot of theatrical metaphors about performances, about how we present ourselves to others. Not only how we show ourselves, but also what we hide and why, how we show ourselves as individuals, how groups show themselves as collectives, and basically gives us kind of a framework to think about the whole topic of impression management. Some are going to find this a difficult read, because if you're into organization studies, there's not a lot of raw theory. It is largely descriptive. But so much of what we have talked about in episodes on more recent works that are in this vein of organization behavior and how people interact, and so, a lot of it draws from this text. And the cover is hilarious. I don't know which version, if there are multiple versions. This version has a picture of two, I'd say, middle-aged women who are dressed to the nines like queens. They're dressed like royalty. And they're sort of putting on what you might say would be an inauthentic happy face, you know, like trying to show themselves off as royalty. And next to them is a lady who is just dressed the total complete opposite, that's in an ungainly pose, not sure what she's doing, but almost looking like she's criticizing the other two. And the title of the photo is The Critic. So that just kind of gives a good sense of what the book is about. You know, how we present ourselves and how we perceive or view or judge others.
Thank you, Tom, for that introduction. Yes, I think this is it's a great book. I think it's important also to contextualize in theoretical terms what we're getting ourselves into. So this is a study of face-to-face interactions. It's, you know, famously known as establishing Goffman dramaturgical analysis and theory of self. So this idea that as people, we control the impressions that we give to other people, and that has implications for how we interact with others and just more generally in social order. And this is a book that is also central to symbolic interactionism theory, which we should briefly mention as well, just to situate our listeners. So symbolic interactionism is this idea that social order is created and maintained through repeated interactions. So when people interact with others, they create meaning, they establish or reinforce or change meaning. And that's how, through the study of these interactions, is how we understand greater social phenomena and how certain things work the way they do and how they can change or be modified over time. So this is, I think, a really good book for anyone also hoping to get into this theory, because I think it's a very easy, I don't know how you guys found it, but I think it's a very kind of easy read. You know, it makes sense. You can immediately be thinking about examples of, you know, the different roles that you play throughout the day and how you try to kind of curate the impression that you give to others and the assumptions that you have going into certain situations about how you should behave and how the others should behave and what they can expect from you. And so for me, it's a really kind of enjoyable, funny read that I think it's pretty accessible.
I have a slightly different opinion, as I didn't think it was a particularly easy read. As I was reading it, I was like thinking about why I found it a difficult book. Part of it is that it's mostly a theoretical book. It does draw upon a lot of examples from government's own research, but also on the research of others, of theses that have been written. So it's very, very rich. But all these different settings that he uses as examples, I found it quite difficult to keep track as I was reading the book and to get the right points out of the examples, as it's pretty dense. There's a lot of information in there. Another reason why I found quite difficult is that it's really a book written in its time. And what I mean with that is that some of the examples he gives is of social interactions and behaviors, which nowadays we would consider slightly outdated. That also pertains to some of the criticisms which we perhaps might get to later in the conversation. But for instance, you know, the interactions and the position of women in society, how women interact with men, the examples he gives, yeah, might strike some irritation among some readers. Also, the way people of color are represented in the book. Yeah, and then I was reflecting upon, like, why is this such a classic and why should we still read it? And that is because even though we would now come up with different examples, like the key theory, the key framework that he suggests in the book, we can still use in our analysis today. And for instance, like one of the scholars that has drawn pretty heavily upon Goffman's work is Steve Barley, and he also wrote it in his latest book, How We Should Study Technology and Work, which I forgot the exact name, but it's published by Oxford University Press, and where he clearly explicates how he draws upon Goffman to study work in organizations and how that is impacted by technological change. So the whole framework of roles, of the stage, role relations, front stage, backstage, different acts in a play, for instance, is a framework that lends itself pretty easily to application in settings other than everyday interactions.
Just to say something quick about you're completely right. Like when you read the examples, you know, you can't help but go like, I'm not sure I would use the same example now. But for me, that's what makes it kind of his points maybe even easier to understand, because now, you know, so much time has passed that now we see these situations that he describes and roles and as kind of outdated, which proves his point of, you know, this is all based on meaning and certain set, you know, how we have defined, how we used to define these situations now. And so I think it's might even be easier for us as readers now in 2023 to understand, you know, the social construction of reality through all the language that he's giving and how that has changed, as opposed to maybe somebody that read it, you know, right when it came up, and you would just kind of read those examples and be like, yeah, that's, you know, that's how things are. It's easier, I think, now to see the social construction of everything that he's representing.
Yeah, and I'll add that not only is it specific to its time, but it was also specific to its place. It's a lot of British examples. And he even admits late in the book that, you know, there could be a lot more done in looking at other settings. He brings in examples of Asian cultures of the time, by the way, that clearly do some things, you know, a lot of things differently in terms of how you do face-to-face interactions. But when he presented it, he sort of shows that, well, you can still use my theory to examine and explain it. But he didn't go that far in the book. He sort of stops at that particular point and left it as sort of like a research question. So the generalizability of the ideas, that came later, of course, but it was good to see how he went in depth on a particular context to build the framework and at least put it forward as a good proposal, which has stood up pretty well. And a lot of I wasn't as bothered by the examples because that was the context, kind of context in which I grew up. It was not so foreign to me, but I was struck by some of the terms used and thinking like, yeah, somebody reading it nowadays is not going to catch some of the terms.
And perhaps that proves the point of the book, that we construct the realities we live in.
Indeed. So I guess we can just kind of dive into the structure of the book. And right away, just going through the table of contents, you'll see some, you'll encounter some terms that don't immediately make sense. I'll get to one in a moment. But so he starts with a very lengthy chapter about the whole idea of performances. What is a performance? What is, how do we present ourselves? And how do we understand or come to analyze the way that people present themselves individually? He then moves to teams, which is where he starts to talk about how groups of people, and not necessarily a cohesive group of people, like just simply others who may physically be present, but how teams come together to shape the environment, in essence, to manage the stage of which individual performances are made. And then the third chapter is regions and region behavior. And this is the one chapter I had the most difficulty with because I didn't understand what he meant by region. But this is where we start talking about front stage behaviors and backstage behaviors. And what happens in the backstage that allows teams to manage, manipulate the environment, shape the conditions under which then individuals can come out to the front stage, to the front of the stage, and deliver a performance. Why he called them regions, I'm not sure. It's probably because he didn't want to use front stage and backstage or some of the existing theatrical terms because it didn't satisfy what he really meant by or what he was looking for. So he just simply called it a region. And then from there, the rest of the book goes into how teams handle folks who communicate out of character. That is, like if an individual violates a performance, or if somebody on the team fails to hold up their end in setting conditions by which then the one who's performing becomes embarrassed. But that's, so for me, the first three chapters were really of making sense of what he's talking about and then getting to all of the different ways in which things can go wrong or things can go differently than what an individual may want to convey in the course of doing their performance.
And perhaps in that sense, if the first three chapters really explicate the theoretical framework, perhaps at that point it might be good to read chapter 7, which I only read in the end, but that's basically the overview of the framework, and then return to the remaining chapters, which are more applications of the framework to understand like odd situations in everyday encounters.
Yeah, I agree with that recommendation. Because the other three are, yes, it's the things that go wrong and how, you know, the safety or protective practices that we have developed around that to kind of correct, you know, when there's discrepancy in roles or there's teams fight in front of each, you know, in front of the audience and like all these things that kind of break with this idea of the meaning of the situation. We can start maybe with just the general. I also find the introduction chapter really just useful just to understand what is this about and why should we care, right? For me, the main idea of the introduction that kind of sets up this the stage for the whole book is, you know, why are people's performance so important that we should be studying that more systematically? The way people perform in certain situations that give meaning and that give information to other people about what they can expect from, you know, let's call it the actor, and what the actor can expect from them. And then this idea that I also found quite amusing of, you know, he seems to have a problem with the idea that people might consciously try to kind of manipulate the definition of the situation by representing themselves in a certain way, which I don't think I have an issue with that. I mean, it's pretty standard. That's what we do in many situations. But he kind of goes into a little bit of saying, you know, how this might be morally wrong. And yeah, so that for me was a kind of main takeaway of the introduction, right? So people's performance is important to define a situation and people have certain control over how they present themselves. And these might be done consciously or unconsciously. You know, we also have roles and social standards of how we automatically act in certain situations. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was also in the introduction that he introduced one study that he continuously goes back to. I mean, yeah, he did bring in some of his own work. And this this was a study of, I'm not sure what a crofter is. it's a foreign term. It was a foreign term to me, but it was basically a study of a rural Shetland Isle area and the way in which it was a tourist attraction in a hotel kind of a setting. But he talks about how those individuals behaved in front of guests versus out of the guest's view, what was presented to the guest physically. You know, we're talking about defining the situation, not just in terms of how an individual portrays him or herself, but also what the setting looks like and how that differs between what's in the front and what's in the back, you know, what's hidden from view and how people interact. You know, I was reminded also of our episode we did on Arlie Hochschild's The Managed Heart. There was a lot of overlap in the ideas. And so you can imagine, like in the area of emotional labor, the act of performing, of being the good host in front of the guest, and then going into the back, and the first thing that comes out is a bunch of curse words about how crummy that person, you know, that particular guest is. So indeed, you know, he gives that as the introduction. And then in that, like I said, really long chapter on performances, he starts to build the terminology. So there's a section on what he calls the front, which is the individual, the presentation of the individual and the setting. And so he starts with the setting, and I'll just quote it from the book, involving furniture, decor, physical layout, other background items which supply the scenery and stage props for the spate of human action played out before, within, or upon it. Where a performance occurs is pretty important, and he uses some examples from Cub Scouts in that. And then there's the appearance and the mannerism of the individual, how the individual is, and a lot of this begins as nonverbal communication. We would sort of think of it as nonverbal communication. How we dress or are dressed for that occasion, how we are acting or reacting, the way that we carry ourselves, all of that is part of the front.
I think you skipped the belief in the part that one is playing, which I think it's also
yes
important.
That's right. Yeah. You want to elaborate?
Sure. So yeah, like the first thing that he notes as kind of an important element of a performance is the degree to which we believe in the part that we are playing. And he kind of talks about these two extremes, right? So the one extreme is, I'm quoting here, the performer can be fully taken in by his own act. He can be sincerely convinced that the impression of reality which he stages is a real reality. And so he talks about the importance of believing in one's own act so that the audience will kind of believe it as well. And he does signal the sociologist's ability to kind of see past this. And even when both the actor and the audience really believe in what is going on, the sociologist can still kind of take a more of a cynical look and understand that this is all part of, you know, a social phenomena, an act of performance and representation. And then on the other extreme, you have the complete disbelief, which he says, you know, it can start as a insecurity, but it can end up in cynicism. So a person who is, you know, knowingly playing a role which they don't actually believe in that role, but then, you know, they keep playing it.
Yeah, I think the opposite of that would be like the role discrepancy that he describes, where people knowingly perform a role, but that they experience some sort of discrepancy with how they see themselves. So if we take this lens of the theater and the stage and drama, and we look at society and at all these small interactions we have with everyone in our lives, we can see how we take on roles. For instance, you can be a teacher in certain settings when you're an academic, and in other settings you're a researcher. What I liked about the study of Goffman, where he draws most examples from, like of the crofters, and I looked it up, it's small agricultural farming, Tom. So these are people in Scotland that have small plots of land that they are subsistent. And so this was, his study was specifically set in a hotel that was run, and where some of the crofters assumed roles of being middle class, on the front stage towards their British guests, whereas others were, you know, working at the backstage, and they were all coming from this same social cultural group of crofters. So in the backstage, they were all similar status and they behaved in the same way. But when they were in the front stage, and some had to be like the hotel manager, whereas the other one was the cleaning lady changing the sheets in the bedroom, or a servant, they had to assume different statuses than they had in the backstage. And I think this really triggered Goffman to write this book about, like, well, like, you, this is not only in the hotel where I studied this, this is everywhere. And we should be aware of it because it helped us understand how society works. What I found intriguing, like, after reading, like, the whole framework and introduction and chapter one, was that he extended it to the team level, that it's not just individuals that take on a role, but it's entire teams, and that it's really social accomplishments. And I think that's also where the relevance of this book's organizational analysis comes in, to really understand how performing a certain function, as in, for instance, an occupation in an organization, how that's not an individual effort, but it's really a group, a team effort.
Yeah, and the example that he uses early on is about interns. And that also harkens back to another episode we did before about socialization of interns in a hospital. I forget which episode it was. I'll look it up. But it's how, like, there's just some shared understanding among all those present about how they're going to act around the intern versus how they may act when the intern is not present, or outside observers. So if you have somebody, like when somebody's coming in who's either an inspector or somebody who's a certifier or an auditor, how behaviors just change and become somehow coordinated or shared to try to protect the organization in those particular instances from too much prying eyes. The sense of team is interesting because it carries a little bit stronger connotation nowadays, I think, than perhaps he intended. These teams may be nothing more than people who just happen to be present in the same situation, and yet because of a shared understanding of what the relationship is between roles and the setting and the situation unfolding of presence of outsiders, etc., that understanding kicks in and everybody starts to act in a coordinated fashion, or one who becomes discrepant, who fails to act in the way that the team wishes, then becomes singled out or becomes an embarrassment or stands out like a sore thumb or something to that effect.
And I think this is a really important point to stress, because we do use a lot of kind of dramaturgical language, you know, this idea of a stage and a front. But I think in a way also to remember how this is a really important book for symbolic interactionism is that it's when people come in contact with others that this kind of stage emerges. You know, if you're in your office alone, you know, you might be behaving in one way. If somebody comes into your office, suddenly you're very aware not only of, you know, who this person is and what that interaction, how it should go about, but also just like how your office is. You know, is it tidy? Is it like a mess? Which is usually when we kind of apologize for, you know, our office not looking like the way it should look. Or so suddenly your office is, you know, it's no longer backstage or private space. It becomes front stage, right? So I think this is really kind of important to note. And he does say, right, so a team is a set of performers who cooperate in presenting a single performance. So I think this is also really interesting, because you might be, you know, engaged in a certain, again, a definition of the situation when you're just with your team and you're kind of playing a certain role there. But as soon as you're, you know, the boss comes in or somebody external comes in, then suddenly, you know, even if you don't like your teammates, you become, you know, that team spirit kind of comes alive, and you know that you all need to be cooperating, even if you don't believe in, you know, the performance that you're giving. And he does say that, but you cooperate to create a certain, you know, illusion, what is expected of you as a team, given the person or people that have come into contact with you.
It's also worth mentioning in the same chapter, he gets into what happens when this shared understanding is imperfect, or when there's deliberate exclusionary tactics, like on page 89, to withhold from a teammate information about the stand his team is taking is in fact to withhold his character from him. For without knowing what stand he will be taking, he may not be able to assert a self to the audience. Which kind of gets into what happens if, for example, for our present, they may all have a shared understanding of how to behave when an outsider comes in, but three are in the know and one is specifically not in the know. What happens? Usually you want the fourth person to really, really be quiet and hide. And it's usually that fourth person who violates that and says something that disrupts the performance of everybody else. So, you know, there's recognition of how teams would want to see themselves, but also I really did appreciate all sorts of circumstances that he provides where teams behave in ways that sometimes even undermine their own intentions. You know, there's a lot of variance that he offers, a lot of different disparate examples that all still tie together to what a team is about.
Yeah. And it's funny now to reflect of all the things that we associate with like team building and, you know, all the kind of tools and theories that we have for this, how they are kind of oriented to getting people within the same team to be in the same page so that they can present kind of a unified performance, right? And he does say also that, you know, when a team kind of makes a mistake, like the others cannot just stop the performance and immediately punish or instruct the offender, but they, you know, they need to keep it going.
Drag him backstage and flog him there.
Yes.
And I think what you're referring to here as well is a term that is very central to drama and theater, but it's not mentioned much in the book, and that's the script. Without the script, there's no play that defines what is going to happen, defines what roles are there. It defines the hierarchy among the different roles, who is the lead character, who is less important, who's the bad guy, who's the good guy. You know, when you think about team building, it's just, you know, to it's basically making everybody aware what the script is of certain situations to behave like a team, right? Or to learn how to interact as a team in non-work settings. Yes, yeah, exactly. No. And when you look at like what is common among the different settings that he draws examples from, for instance, you have like the hospital setting, you have like psychiatric ward that he has some examples from. He mentions the training of medical students and interns, hotel that he studied in Scotland. One thing that is common is that these are all very hierarchical settings where the roles have clear role relations and one is superior, the other one is a subordinate. And perhaps that's the commonality as well that's defined by the scripts, which is very clear in theater and in orchestras as well. Like, you know, we also have the scripts, we have the score, which tells like what the role of everybody is at every moment in time.
Yeah, I think that examples that he uses, because it's based on studies that he has done, which are typically, you know, he's when you look at his studies, they are typically very hierarchical organizations. But there was an element of performance that we didn't talk about in chapter one. That is this idea of idealization. And for me there, because he talks about, you know, how as performers, we always try to deliver, you know, our performance in a way that it matches what audiences are used to. So this idea of socialization and how. So for me, that kind of opens it up to, we might see that in everyday interactions that maybe don't happen in the context of a very hierarchical organization, right? Like if you go, your interaction with, you know, with someone at the bank or the supermarket, or it's always supposed to happen in a certain way. And there are certain things that you might do that then kind of break, you know, the order of that situation, and then they stand out as inappropriate behavior or whatever. So I think we can see it in many other settings that are not strictly hierarchical organizations, but because he gives primarily examples from his previous studies. Yeah.
Yeah, and indeed, there was also another element that makes this a reading for its time, was that the hierarchy is kind of set in a almost classist sort of a way. He's used a lot of examples from royalty, you know, from traditional conceptions of royalty, supervisory relationships. He made specific references in a couple of places about overall authoritarian organizations and deference, where deference to authority is treated as if it's just normal, because that was normal for that particular time. And it helps to explain a lot of the relationships that he saw between superordinates and subordinates, that so much of the behavior is unscripted behavior, I guess. In the absence of any other information, the shared understanding of deference just sort of takes over. And I'm reading again from page 89 and 90, where he's talking about things like etiquette and decorum as ways of explaining what the purpose, or not the purpose, but what the shared understanding produces and the behaviors of individuals in the absence of any other guiding information. Found that to be very useful. But it also highlights how things have changed. And with the informality of culture that we see nowadays, the context is different. And yet there's still an understanding that there's etiquette, decorum. It's just different. It's not the way that we have traditionally used those terms, because we are nearly as formally oriented a culture as it was in 1959.
Yeah, I would even say, and maybe this is a stretch, but I would even say it's even more relevant when we think about, you know, what would associate as kind of modern organizations, more horizontal and decentralized. And because whereas in a very hierarchical formal organization, you know, you could kind of maintain a backstage when you're among colleagues, but then if, you know, a superior comes in, then you suddenly are in front, at the front stage, and you need to perform in a certain way. I feel that now, you know, my experience working with some of these organizations is that you need to maintain that performance all the time, right? You cannot behave in certain ways that contradicts the values and the principles of the organization. It doesn't matter who you're around. So I would say it's even maybe perhaps even more relevant to modern organizations.
I think I agree with you, Samantha. You know, when you think about who is a good improviser, it's when you, for instance, look at jazz, it's somebody that knows the music in and out and knows how to recombine and improvise on the spot, pasting fragments together. And I think when you think about modern organizations or modern life, what is the front stage and what is the backstage? Who is the audience? Who is the observer? Who are you acting for? Is much more dynamic, perhaps. Also with the rise of social media, you know, you never know when you are being recorded and where it ends up and who will be the viewer. That creates perhaps more skill even in, yeah, the way you present yourself, or just being okay to have an absolute ignorance to it all. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's also perhaps a source of stress. You know, you think about all of the cues that in the formal hierarchical or class-based or whatever, you know, there were all sorts of cues that were sort of built in that signaled to others who was high class, who was low status, who was a supervisor versus a worker, or what roles that people played, such that you were comfortable to an extent of being able to know when you were in the front versus when you were in the safe haven of the rear, in the front region versus the rear region, or in the backstage. You kind of had an understanding of where the differences were. So you could make those mental judgments, you could avoid embarrassment, you can do all that sort of thing. But now with the blending comes great stress, because now with the informality comes an inability to know precisely who you are dealing with, who is the audience in front of you, who is the observers on you. When are you really in a safe haven? Certainly, you can talk about social media and what that's done in part two. And I do think that is a stressor, not really knowing the situation, which makes it that much more difficult to define the situation. Because a lot of what he gets into in this is how people define the situation in a way that allows for that shared understanding to kick in, which again helps to alleviate stress. It allows people to just simply work on automatic and and engage in the situation in a way that doesn't that avoids risk, I guess would be a good way to put it.
Yes. Yeah, I think we should go back to this you know, this idea that front and backstage distinction has faded away, maybe for the second part. And I think something that is useful, and we haven't talked about this idea of regions that you didn't love so much, Tom. I didn't mind his use of region. I think I would have used space as a more kind of common word, but this idea that a region or a space is constructed, right? So you have barriers of perception that you can move around and that allow you to make this distinction between the front and the back region.
Yeah, in that sense, I also see a lot of overlap with the work of Pierre Bourdieu, who talks about the fields and where you can have a position in different fields that might partly overlap, might not. For instance, the backstage of the hotel. In the hotel, that was the backstage among the workers themselves. There was a particular setting where people from the crafter society were there, and they could just have their own habits. For instance, you know, the type of food that they ate, the way they held their cutlery, how the women were allowed to sit in unwomanly positions on the lunch table, because that was commonly accepted in the crafter society, while in British society, which were the guests, that was like totally, they should not see any of that. So these were quite juicy details of the book. But, you know, in terms of Bourdieu, that all refers to how societies have relations, the scripts and the habitus, there's overlap there. The class system that is pretty prevalent in government writing, and how Bourdieu says in the end, it all comes back to power. Yeah, I see quite a bit of overlap between these two very important and influential sociologists.
Do we want to get into a little bit of the application and the discussion of the later part of the book, like discrepant roles? I think we teed up some of it, but it may be worth taking a little closer look, because, I mean, the second half of the book is focused on all of the contingencies. You know, once you've actually set this up, where you've laid out the stage, you have the shared understandings, you have the situation unfolding before you, people are there, and then somebody messes up, I guess is a good way to put it. For example, in the discrepant roles chapter, which is actually, you know, I was actually going ahead to the communication out of character, which is where somebody screws up. But the discrepant roles, what he's really kind of talking about here, and I guess it may be a different version, a different meaning of discrepant than I'm used to. The sentence on page 141 is probably the best way to, you know, sort of capture it. It's that these are roles whose existence is to allow a team to keep its secrets and have its secrets kept. That is, it's not enough to have a backstage where the negotiations or the discussions happen or the shaping of the situation occurs. But there are all these roles played by people in the backstage that basically is used to do the shaping. The fact that the shaping takes place, even though, you know, logically everybody knows that those roles, these activities take place, it's important to keep them hidden just because. What he talks about here is different kinds of secrets. There's dark secrets, facts about a team which it knows and conceals and which are incompatible with the image of self that the team attempts to maintain before its audience. So it's basically, it is a secret that is known that is being purposefully hidden from view. If it were to get out, the whole performance is just shot. There's nothing left to the performance. There's also, he had strategic secrets, which are things that a team conceals from its audience in order to prevent them from adapting effectively to the state of affairs. So it's sort of like a secret, a shared understanding of the how we respond to a contingency. What if somebody figures out who we really are and tries to act on it? We are going to prevent that from happening so we can keep our performance aligned. And then the other one is Inside Secrets, which is what allows the group to know who's in the group and who's out of the group, I guess is the best way to put it. Like by going through all of those, it sort of like helps to explain, all right, what kind of shaping is going on? What are the secrets? What kind of information is shared? He classifies different types of information. And he also classifies a number of roles where the backstage, you know, who does what in the backstage to do the shaping. And that that was a lot of fun reading for myself because he gave really good examples of each of these taking place.
Are you thinking of the stick and the shillower?
Yeah, I confess that some of these terms were totally foreign to me. So
I liked, so there are a couple of roles that I thought were very similar to what ethnographers do, which I thought, I found interesting the idea of discrepant roles, because I think when I started reading the chapter, I assumed it was going to be about, you know, people not playing the role that they should play. But when I look at the, you know, the informer, the shill, the mediator, the servant, the confidant, it's, I understand it more as people that play a role that cannot be firmly classified into one category, right? Like these are usually people that are in and out, or they, you know, they are there, but they don't belong, and they have access to the secrets of the team, but they don't necessarily belong only to the team. They, you know, they might be doing some work somewhere else. And I thought the role of the informer, somebody that pretends to be a member of the team, but is allowed to come backstage and acquire destructive information, and also the role of confidant, is pretty like similar to what ethnographers come and do in organizations, right? You know, they have access, they're there, they hear all these things, people trust in them, and then they leave, right? And they do other stuff with that information, hopefully not destructive stuff. But
we already touched upon that there is a function. There is usefulness in applying this framework. Why I'm saying this is because I also got really annoyed by reading the book, but perhaps we go into part two, where that annoyance came from. How our mind works and how we classify people in certain categories like doctors, nurses, policemen, it helps us also make life predictable in certain ways to know how we should approach people. There's sort of predictability, efficiency, some shared understanding you mentioned, Tom, which is needed in order for a society to function, especially when societies become bigger and denser and intenser. Now, even more than before, perhaps we should understand why this happens. But at the same time, what we see, because this book was published in 1959, and so we're now in 2023, and in that time period, a lot has changed. And we already referred to the outdated arguments, but also where we are in a society where people may have scripts in their head that don't meet the reality anymore that we live in. And for instance, you know, one example, and I won't mention who it pertains to, but it's a colleague of mine, a very bright academic scholar, a young woman who came to deliver a talk. She was the invited speaker, the guest of honor. And, you know, when you go and deliver a speech, you dress formally. So she put on a black dress. It was a young woman. And so she comes to the venue and she wants to present herself. And immediately a guy comes to her like, oh, I'm glad you're here. Here's my jacket. Can you hang it for me? So he was acting on the assumption that her role was she was an employee of the venue and she was staff. And he was like one of the other speakers or I don't know, like maybe a very high level guest. And then she told me this very often happens to her. And I think this happens to a lot of people that now take on functions that previously were not open to them, where you see like this incongruity, like the role you have and what people expect the role you can have as being very different. So I was like, well, how did you respond? She said, well, I just hung up the jacket and then I was on the stage giving the talk. And so where Goffman, I think in one of the latter chapters, talks about like, oh my Lord, like expressions where we know we're out of character. He's mentioning it in different contexts. context, like, you know, the army officer that takes his wife for a ride in an army car in his, you know, normal gear rather than his uniform. But we encounter more situations where the scripts we have in our head might not completely fit with the reality we live in anymore, because there's more openness, more fluidity, and also more, I think, more equal opportunity. Where on the one hand, we need to adjust, but we also need to, you know, be kind that sometimes we may make mistakes ourselves, or other people might make mistakes. And I think that's, I don't know if this makes sense, but I think this framework is helpful for understanding that these situations can happen. And what I miss is like how we deal with it. But I think that is a big question that we should ask and should think about.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.